Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Coming up on the program, workers at the recently bankrupt coal company Black Jewel are not waiting at home for the gates to reopen. A network of support has formed on a Facebook page.
You know, I just figured the page would be throw some information together, put some job openings on there, and I never imagined it to grow like it has.
We'll also learn about how the Northern Arapaho Tribe's Historic Preservation Office has taken on an ambitious project, creating a record of every person who's buried on the Wind River Reservation.
There's really no rhyme and reason for this cemetery.
And Wyoming residents and others finally got to check out the restored Capitol building.
It speaks volumes. It's a building that speaks loudly.
Those stories and more here on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. More than a week has passed since Black Jewel filed for bankruptcy and sent home 576 workers. They're still waiting to hear if they've been laid off or heading back to work soon. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports employees are stuck in limbo, though many aren't struggling to keep busy.
Rory Wallet walks into the Campbell County Library and asks for a key to the conference room. The tattooed and bearded Black Jewel worker is helping set up a meeting with his coworkers. Since he was sent home July 1st, he's traded in his old full-time job for a new one, of sorts, setting up a support network for Black Jewel workers.
I've been busy 24/7.
Wallet has become the face of Wyoming's Black Jewel employees. It all started when he opened up a Facebook group.
Last week, I just figured the page would be throw some information together, put some job openings on there, and I never imagined it to grow like it has.
Now, Wallet's days are packed. Sometimes he's setting up a place to meet, like today. He's sending people groceries. He's even working to support Black Jewel employees in Appalachia who are also out of a job. Like one family who couldn't afford their son's medicine.
So he's on chemo, and his chemo meds were running out, and the insurance had dropped back east, so we just put it on our credit or debit card. It was no big deal.
But Wallet has four kids and a lot to worry about himself. Helping people is helping him cope with the stress.
It's great that we're focusing on the positives, that we're not sitting there and just sitting at home getting drunk. Let's pay it forward however we can and keep it going, and we're a big family.
Wallet is just the tip of the iceberg. In a week, the whole city of Gillette has started to buzz. This is a weekday when all 600 of Black Jewel's employees would otherwise be at work. Yet they're busy tackling another job, forming prayer circles all over the city, responding to Facebook requests for grocery and bill help, handing out petitions, planning fundraisers, like three women stationed at a kitchen table in a white ranch home outside of Gillette. Kelly Coulter is one of them. She works for an organization called Thrivent Financial and is using her skills to raise money and help families feel comfortable in this time of limbo.
But I think the anticipation of not knowing what to expect, that's the thing that's really eating people up. Is if they knew, okay, well, this is going to go on for this amount of time, or here's what's coming in the future, but it's terrifying.
Former Eagle Butte worker Michelle Young sits at her kitchen table with Coulter. She says groceries and medicine isn't all that's needed.
I mean, some of these guys work 20, 15 years even at the mine. They don't know anything else. Like, that's their life. That's what they know. And so they don't even know how to fill out a resume, get online, fill out applications.
Over at Gillette College, several local and state agencies are presenting available resources to about 40 Black Jewel employees.
And I want to welcome you all to our informational session.
That's Rick Manschein, manager at the Gillette Workforce Center. He introduces representatives to talk about unemployment, insurance options, job fairs. He says the center has grown to average 70 visitors a day now. Manschein says many Black Jewel folks he's met already have new jobs.
Most places are underemployed and looking for employees. If there's a bright side to this, it's that timing was in a situation where people are looking for employees.
Even Black Jewel was looking to hire people before they went bankrupt. The sun starts to go down as a buzzing Gillette settles for the night. It's breezy and warm outside Rory Wallet's house. Friends of his, Sean and Tandy, are over, both equipment operators for Black Jewel. They didn't want to include their last names. bills are coming due for them, and their last paychecks didn't even cash, so they're feeling pretty desperate.
A couple of hours, I was getting ready to go visit my son. We're on our way, and I look at my bank account, and I'm upside down, that whole check. I've never had a negative bank account.
The couple have canceled their monthly payments like Netflix and cable. Now they can't even get their car out of a mechanic. Friends have been helping, but it's been stressful.
He can only mow the lawn so many times in 1 week. You know, there's not much we can do sitting at home.
Luckily, Sean's old employer is giving him his job back. Tandy's trying to find some houses to clean while it shoves a wad of cash in Sean's pocket before they head home.
Take care, guys.
Yeah, we're working on
it. Like I said, Sean, get away.
Wallet now sits outside, still on his phone, responding to messages, and says once he goes back to work, he can finally relax. His wife, Brandy, says she's wanted to throw that thing in the trash a few times. Their four kids join them outside, avoiding branches standing by them.
This is Patrick. He's our 16-year-old. This is Spencer.
They like having Mr. Mom around, as he calls himself. But his youngest, Ashlyn, hopes her dad doesn't stick around too long.
I want him to go back to work.
I want him to go back to work.
Wallet, Sean, Tandy, and the many others hold out hope they can return from this job to their old one sooner than later. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Now shifting to another of Wyoming's important industries. In January 2018, gun manufacturer Weatherby announced it was moving from its home in California and resettling in Sheridan. The company makes rifles, shotguns, and ammunition. The move signified a chance for more economic diversification in the Sheridan area. Last month, Weatherby opened for business north of downtown. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler asked owner and CEO Adam Weatherby why he decided to move the business to Wyoming.
My grandfather started the business in 1945 in California, so we'd been in California for 74 years. So it was obviously a really big decision, but California had changed a lot. Business climate, tax climate, and then really gun climate too in regards to Second Amendment. So there were a number of things that really led us up where years ago we knew it was probably inevitable that for our business to really carry on and flourish, it needed to be out of California.
And so what about Wyoming and particularly Sheridan really fit for you?
Typically when you leave something for a variety of reasons, you want to go somewhere else for the opposite reasons. And so we left a state that was probably worst in regards to business tax climate, and we came to the state that's been number one best tax climate for 3-4 years running or whatever from the Tax Foundation. So Wyoming has more guns per capita, and I think we'll fight till the end to, you know, uphold our Second Amendment, which is very important. So Sheridan really stood out for a variety of reasons. We knew we needed to be by the interstate, and really the workforce was important. And really from the get-go there, Dr. Young at the Sheridan College and really their whole staff provided just, I think, a lot of different ways for us to kind of partner with them, as well as really some other manufacturers in town and some different things that we knew we'd be able to get the workforce here we needed. So we had to recruit a number of people from our industry out of the state. And we knew that Sheridan, with the Bighorn Mountains, the kind of vibrant downtown, the Main Street, kind of that New West that they call it, would really be a place where people would want to move their families. So it really had kind of a blend of kind of all of those things in one, ended up, I think, being just kind of the perfect match for Weatherby.
What kinds of jobs are you adding to Sheridan?
We have about a little over 70 employees that work for us. I believe that'll be growing as our business grows here and we start manufacturing more here in Sheridan. So out of the 70, 18 of us moved from California. So over 50 people we had to hire in this past year. We recruited 15 from around the country. And then all the rest of them, we hired mostly from within Wyoming and even here locally in Sheridan.
What are you looking forward to most about growing your business?
You know, it's neat because I think Sheridan just fits our brand so well. And I think at Grand Opening, I think people understood that. And it's even neat to be able to entertain people when folks come. I mean, we have different suppliers and key marketing partners and all sorts of groups that end up coming to Weatherby. And so now we get to kind of boast Sheridan as really our backyard and a bit of who we are. And so it's a part of our culture now, you know, going forward. So last Thursday night, we had, I think, a table up downtown. And man, we sold out of like hats and t-shirts, you know, just trying to let people know we're here. And so everybody's really kind of, I think, excited about us being here.
as you like get more into that community, are there any things that you really want to do, like, you know, get involved in like community efforts? Is there anything that you're thinking of or plans you have to get involved?
Yeah, one of the things that we did on our grand opening day is we had 11 conservation groups a part of our grand opening. Most of those are nationwide conservation groups. Some of them aren't. Some are more regional. But we invited all the local chapters. I think we donated a couple guns to each chapter, for instance. They sold raffle tickets. They kept all those proceeds, and so that helped. And so, yeah, we definitely do want to be a vital and vibrant part of the community, not just employing people, but in a variety of different ways. But I think we'll need to find kind of what that shape is. We certainly can't say yes to all the things. But say like that, it's like, hey, that makes sense. Like, hey, we provide products for people to get out there and get in the outdoors. Let's help protect our outdoors. Let's help conserve wildlife. Let's help do those things. So it really makes sense. So it's got to really align with kind of our brand and vision and those different things.
Thank you, Adam, for joining me. I appreciate you making some time to talk with me.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me on.
Stay tuned. Coming up, we'll hear about hopes to return wolves to Colorado. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Over the past several decades, gray wolves have been reintroduced to places throughout the Mountain West in Montana, Idaho, and Yellowstone National Park. But those programs have been decided on and carried out primarily by government wildlife agencies. Colorado wolf advocates want to do things differently. They want to bring the question to the ballot box. Allie Budner reports.
The last place you might expect to find a wolf is inside a public library, a place that doesn't even allow pets in the door. But today, Shia, a so-called wolf ambassador, is pacing the fourth floor of the downtown library in Pueblo, Colorado. He's surrounded by an enthusiastic crowd.
He might lick you in the face, too.
Shia is a grayish-white, pale-eyed creature from a wildlife center about an hour away. His handler, Michelle Smith, explains he's mostly wolf with a touch of domesticated dog. Smith holds Shia on a leash, hands him the occasional piece of beef jerky, and answers questions from a swarm of excited kids.
Maybe pet the wolf? Are wolves related to foxes?
Shia may be the event's main attraction, but there's a bigger goal here beyond just giving kids a chance to see a wild animal like this up close. The event is educating potential voters. There's a table in the corner here with volunteers and pamphlets about wolves. A group called the Rocky Mountain Wolf Action Fund is working to get an initiative on the state ballot for 2020.
And what that language says is very simple.
Delia Malone is a Sierra Club ecologist.
Do Coloradans want wolves restored to Colorado?
Specifically to federal public lands in the mountains of western Colorado. Gray wolves once roamed across nearly all of the Mountain West. Malone says they disappeared from the greater region and from Colorado more than 75 years ago after they were targeted for extermination. Whether or not that's a good thing depends on who you ask. Here's Malone's take.
There are so many myths that wolves are going to kill all your livestock, that wolves are going to kill all the elk and all the deer. That hasn't been proven out scientifically.
There are places where elk numbers have drastically declined after wolves were put on the landscape.
That second voice is Blake Henning with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, a hunting advocacy group. He says if that kind of decline were to happen in Colorado, we'd lose more than elk. We'd lose money.
A lot of non-residents go to Colorado to hunt elk. That's a significant driver for small towns and has a significant economic impact.
Colorado has the most elk of any state in the country, around 280,000 of them. Experts say gray wolves might kill about 3% of them per year, far fewer than hunters do. But Henning says it's not just hunting interests at stake. Ranchers, too, will suffer the cost.
And costs not only just in livestock loss, but man hours, managing a herd, dealing with stress on animals.
The ballot initiative does say that livestock owners would be compensated for any animals killed by wolves, but Henning says that might not repair all the damage done, and he's skeptical of putting this decision in the hands of regular voters.
We think the rightful decision maker should be the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Game Commission.
And he says that agency's stance has so far been clear. It's funded in large part by hunting and fishing licenses. As recently as 2016, it said it did not support a reintroduction of gray wolves because of potential conflict with the state's livestock industry and big game like deer and elk.
My gosh, there's plenty of deer and elk.
That's veteran wolf biologist Mike Phillips. He's currently a Democratic state senator in Montana and director of the Ted Turner Endangered Species Fund. In 1995, he helped lead the reintroduction of gray wolves to Yellowstone National Park. He says wolves actually keep elk and deer populations, as well as entire ecosystems, healthier.
They will hunt frequently enough to cause the deer and elk to behave slightly differently. That brings a relief to vegetation. And when the vegetation isn't being pressed so by grazing and browsing deer and elk, it begins to change, inevitably making any ecological setting richer and more diverse than it would be otherwise.
He also says livestock kills are fairly rare, and there are non-lethal ways of keeping wolves at a distance, like tying flags to fence posts.
We know a lot about gray wolves. So when we speak about what restoration would look like in Colorado, we're speaking from decades of experience.
A recent bipartisan poll showed roughly two-thirds of Colorado voters support reintroducing gray wolves in the state. The Rocky Mountain Wolf Action Fund will start collecting signatures this summer to get their initiative onto next year's ballot. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Allie Budner.
Turning to another kind of wandering critter, the landscape painter. The Whitney Western Art Museum at the Buffalo Bills Center of the West hosted explorer artist Tony Foster for a week. For the past 35 years, Foster has taken journeys to paint wild places, many of them in the American West. Before his residency at the Buffalo Bills Center, he went on a rafting journey on the Green River. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska sat down with Foster to get a better understanding of what it means to be an explorer artist today.
I travel into wild places in order to make my work. All my paintings are about wilderness, and so that implies that you go to places where, okay, I've probably never been to anywhere where nobody's ever set foot, but I've certainly been to lots of places where very few people have ever been in order to make my paintings.
How did you get interested to become an explorer painter? I don't feel like that's very common to hear anymore these days.
No, I don't think I've ever seen it on any curriculum in school order to train to be one. I guess I got into it sort of by accident, really, in that my first exhibition in the States was about Henry Thoreau, the great 19th century philosopher and wilderness exponent. And I did an exhibition about the trails that he went on into the wilderness in Maine. And when I went up to Maine, I realized that something which is not really a European concept at all existed, which was that there are really extraordinarily wild places which had the appearance, at least, that nobody had ever been there before. And there was no mark of human beings on them at all. And this really became my life's inspiration, the idea that these wild places still existed with no marks of humans at all. And I've really continued with working on that theme ever since.
How does your process work?
Well, it's hard work, I'll tell you that. because if you can imagine, you know, the average backpacking trip for most people consists of carrying a tent and a sleeping bag and a stove and some food. But for me, it consists of a tent, a sleeping bag, a stove, some food, a drawing board, an aluminium tube with rolled up sheets of watercolour paper, a paint box, some brushes, and all the paraphernalia that you need in order to make paintings on site. And so it's pretty arduous, really. And I must say, at the age of 73, it's getting harder and harder. And so the way I've resolved that slight problem is to suggest to younger people that if I pay their airfare, they can come and have an adventure, but they have to carry half the stuff.
And so tell me about your most recent journey. As I understand, you went along the Green River.
Well, I went to the Green River actually last year in order to paint Steamboat Rock. As I was doing this painting, I was looking at this wonderful river swirling past the Steamboat Rock, and I was with a friend from Ketchum, Idaho, and I said, hey, Chris, why don't we think about rafting the river? And so He drafted the river, the Green, several times, and he said, yeah, I'll organise it if you like. So we put together a raft trip and went from, only a short trip, unfortunately, from the gates of Lidor to Split Rock, which was basically a five-day, four-night trip. And I did a painting every day on that trip, and I'm still finishing those small works at the moment.
When I was looking at your paintings online, I noticed that you have what you call souvenirs on the bottom, and that really intrigued me. How did you decide to start doing that?
Well, I think it's because the paintings aren't simply about, you know, sort of metaphorically putting a frame around a particularly beautiful piece of landscape and copying it. They're much more about trying to explain what it's like to actually live in these places and what it's like to hike into them and to live in a tent and the things that you encounter. And in a way, it's a bit like trying to prove that I've actually been there. So if I come back with some talismanic object that I've found on the way, then that sort of proves I've been there. And so sometimes they're highly symbolic, and sometimes they're slightly political, and sometimes they make a commentary of some sort.
And is there a specific souvenir that stands out to you from your last journey on the Green River?
I went to the most wonderful place, I thought it was wonderful anyway, called Warfield Quarry, which is near a place called Kemmerer. And you can go chip away at the stone and reveal all sorts of beautiful little fossils of little fish. And I'd wanted to get some of those because I wanted to apply those as souvenirs to the Green River paintings, because this is the Green River formation. And what I wanted to say about that was that the river has this enormous 50 million year history. And although we see it in the present and we enjoy it in the present, it's always been there. And it has this wonderful, wonderful history, which is revealed by these fabulous little fossils of fish, which will appear underneath the paintings. I'm delighted to found them.
Has your perception of the wild changed in the past 35 years that you've been doing this for?
I suppose I'm more conscious now of just how much under threat it is. When I started, I thought that sort of wildernesses were there partly because nobody had really thought of a way of exploiting them, and so they'd been left alone, and partly, particularly in America, where they were wonderfully well protected. But since then, I've realized I did a journey in the primary rainforest in Honduras, which was a 14-day journey on a river journey, and it was through absolutely untouched primary forest. But in fact, in the short time since I did that, which is about 12 years, I suppose, the place is now completely overrun with drug runners, and it's been logged, and it's so dangerous to go in there now that you can't go in without the army. And so you realize actually that these places are constantly under threat as soon as anybody thinks of a means of exploiting them.
How does that make you feel, that you still have to go and paint more of these wild places before they maybe change?
Well, it's not so much that I simply want to document places which are about to disappear. I would much prefer to be doing work which in some way inspires people to protect them. And my work, I think most people who see my work think of it as beautiful. And when they see them, they are inspired to think, well, gosh, these places are fantastically beautiful. We really should do everything we can to protect them. And if only I thought that getting that kind of message across would have any impact, then I'd be happier. But I'm not sure really that the trouble is that the pressure against them is so great that I think that a solitary painter bringing back wonderful paintings of fantastically beautiful places may not be enough to protect them, really. I guess in the end, it's about the pressure for exploitation against the pressure for preservation. And that's a conflict that's been going on for a very long time in all sorts of areas. And that pressure is increasing, I think.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Good. Well, I enjoyed that very much. Thanks for our conversation.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaking with landscape artist Tony Foster.
When we return, we'll hear about a project to map cemeteries on the Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. St. Stephen's Indian Mission was founded in 1884 on the Wind River Reservation. Still operates today as a Catholic church, and thousands of people are buried in the cemetery there. Many graves at St. Stephen's are marked with elaborately painted works of art rather than a headstone. But some older graves are not marked at all. This summer, the Northern Arapaho Tribe's Historic Preservation Office has taken on an ambitious project, creating a record of everyone who's buried on the reservation. As Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports, they're starting with the cemetery at St. Stephen's.
If you've driven past this cemetery along 17-mile road this summer, you might have noticed a couple of young men walking around in the hot sun carrying notebooks. Jordan Dresser and Nico Holt started mapping this cemetery in early June. At first, they thought it might take 2 weeks.
Oh yeah, 10 skin tones ago, and when we were both young men with clean-shaven faces.
The process has proved a little more tedious than they hoped. Here's how it works. The team has divided St. Stephen's Cemetery into 5 sections. When they approach a new grave, they assign it a number within that section. Then Holt uses a handheld GPS device to find the grave's exact coordinates.
All right, you ready? 2714.
Today, Nick Quiver Whiteplume and Corwin Howell are logging that information into a physical chart, along with the person's name, birth, and death date. Then Dresser takes a photo of the grave. What all of this adds up to is a database that tells you the exact location of every grave in the cemetery, who's buried there, and how to find them. Dresser says this is useful for a couple of reasons. For one, the graves in St. Stephen's aren't organized in a grid.
There's really no rhyme and reason to the cemetery. You have a grave this way, that way, you know? And it's just really how people were buried.
And while some of the newer graves are marked with marble headstones, most have wooden crosses.
Wood deteriorates, you know? If you look at some of them, they're not that old. Like, some of them probably were from the 80s, but already they deteriorate. There's a brand new one over there, and the cross is already gone.
Because of that, many graves at St. Stephen's are not clearly marked.
See, and look at this one right here. Like, it's wood, it's painted, but you could just see it chipping already. You could barely make out the name. So that's one. There's another unknown right here.
Bridger Lawson is familiar with these challenges. When he got the job as groundskeeper at St. Stephen's Mission, he inherited a bin full of old burial records.
Take it out of here.
He unfurls a laminated map of the cemetery, drawn in neat freehand. Each grave is marked carefully with a number, but the names that correspond with those numbers are a mystery.
The guys that were here before me told me there was a key for this that matched it up, but I've never found it. But they said it's here somewhere, I don't know.
Like a lot of Northern Arapaho people, Lawson has family buried at St. Stephen's.
My great-grandpas, my grandma-grandpa, my aunts, uncles.
He says that an updated map and database will be useful to people who have trouble locating their relatives.
A lot of families that are out of town, like mine, that come in and they want to go see somebody they haven't seen for a long time over at the cemetery, it'll be easier to use the map to go find them. Because it's really easy to lose track. You know, we do have a lot of funerals, so it fills up pretty quick.
But the project has also been useful in identifying some of those unmarked graves in St. Stephen's. Back at the cemetery, Dresser points out a grave that isn't marked, but has a painted vase full of flowers placed on top of it. He says that's a sign that somebody in the community knows who's buried there.
We've been very public about this project because we want people who do know who these people are to come forward and say, this is so-and-so. Because the idea is, down the road, we would love to find grants where we could get them proper markers.
Sometimes, Dresser and his team come across a grave that stirs up emotions for them. A grave that belongs to a loved one or to an ancestor who was repatriated. They suspect that some of the unmarked graves belong to children who died when the mission was a boarding school. But they've also learned about their tribe and their families by spending time at St. Stephen's. That's one of the reasons why Dresser says this place is worth preserving.
These graves all tell a story in a sense, and it tells a story about tribal people. It breaks your heart when you do see these unknowns. It breaks your heart when you see these graves that are unattended. But then it fills your heart when you see the graves like that one right there with the flowers on it. And in a way, we're trying to do that for all of them. And we're trying to show them that respect and the love that they have here.
While most of the community feedback has been positive, Dresser says a few people would rather the project didn't move forward. They see it as an unnecessary disturbance of a sacred place. Still, the Historic Preservation Office has plans to map every cemetery and identify every grave on Wind River. They have at least 15 to go, and the team's next stop is the Chief Black Coal Cemetery in Arapahoe. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation.
Pockets of the rural West are getting richer as wealthier Americans are drawn to rustic small towns across the region. But as our Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgey reports, that new money comes at a cost.
I'm riding my bike along a busy road in the Heber Valley in Utah. This place looks like a little Switzerland. Jagged, snowy mountains, bright green pastures, dairy cows. Sue Nathanson is my riding partner. And she tells me over the roar of traffic and wind that every summer, the valley has a Swiss Days festival and even hosts a sheepdog championship.
And the dogs do these tricks. It's amazing.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, they do.
Sue and her husband Rick moved to the Heber Valley 4 years ago. They like to spend their days playing and watching pickleball in Heber Valley's new pickleball courts, or biking along roads like this. We cruise past a Mexican restaurant and a cute bakery before busting up a hill and stopping at a little park with a pond and some ducks. A kid and his grandpa are fishing there. It's all very bucolic. And it's one of the reasons why the Nathansons moved here.
It was more farms. It was more open land.
And the other reason they moved here?
Tell them why we moved here.
I always wanted to ski Deer Valley.
Deer Valley is an upscale, world-class ski resort about a half an hour from town.
Best groomed skiing in all of America. And so we came down here and he had never yet skied it, and we bought a house anyway.
It's the second house they own. The other one is in Palm Springs, California. Rick was in the insurance business until he retired 2 years ago, and the Nathansons are financially comfortable. According to a recent report from the nonprofit group Headwaters Economics, the Nathansons are part of a growing number of well-off retirees and stock market investors that are flocking to rural recreation paradises like this across the Mountain West. These wealthy transplants are pumping cash into once sleepy logging or farming towns.
These are places that are struggling to hold on to residents.
Megan Lawson is an economist who authored the report.
They're dealing with population loss and people moving away.
She says rural and semi-rural counties with lots of hiking, biking, skiing, good restaurants, they're growing, while other rural counties in the West are shrinking. And the people that are moving to these recreation meccas are often richer than those moving to counties without those opportunities.
This kind of validates outdoor recreation as an economic development strategy that can bring decent jobs, that can bring new residents to the community, not just tourists.
The growth is visible here in the Heber Valley. New bakeries, restaurants, and even a microbrewery are popping up. Downtowns are being revitalized, and city parks are getting an upgrade. Changes that Rick Nathanson and his wife Sue appreciate.
Well, that sports complex where we were playing pickleball today is very nice.
Yeah, they're recognizing the needs of the community and recognizing how many people are playing pickleball, and so now they're putting in 6 more pickleball courts.
Pickleball, yoga, aquatic centers. The Heber Valley is definitely modernizing. But for some of these rural paradises, the growth isn't all good.
Rents have just skyrocketed.
That's Dave Booth. He's the police chief of Heber City, and he says it's becoming really hard to find places for his staff to live. In rural towns like this,
everybody, I think, would like to have a home with a yard and a neighborhood to raise a family.
But housing prices have doubled here over the past decade, and the median listing price right now is well over $500,000. That's 9 times the median income of a family living in the valley. Booth worries that rich transplants are pushing out Heber's school teachers and police officers. The people who make a town a town.
Why should it be said, hey, if you're a cop in Heber City, you shouldn't be able to have this? If that day comes, then the cops are going to have to live somewhere else, and I think that's a shame.
Back at the Duck Pond, retirees Sue and Rick Nathanson say they are well aware of the housing crisis unfolding in the Heber Valley. They also know that they're kind of to blame.
Absolutely. We are part of the problem.
And she says it's a problem that's pushing out more than just the valley's workers. The quaint dairy farms that the Nathansons fell in love with when they first moved here are quickly transforming into a maze of subdivisions and big mansion-like houses. Eventually, the Nathansons say, they'll move away. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Heber City, Utah.
University of Wyoming Senior Associate Athletics Director and Senior Woman Administrator China Jude was recently named the president of the Minority Opportunities Athletics Association. The goal of the organization is to get more minorities into athletics administration. She tells me about her goals during the two-year term.
Supporting people who advocate for ethnic minorities in the intercollegiate space. We represent NCAA institutions, Division I, II, and III, as well as NAIA and junior colleges. We have about 700 members, and I'm very excited to serve as the president of this organization for the next 2 years.
What are some of your goals coming in?
So we're working on a rebranding effort. When the organization started, it was to really be able to have the opportunity to provide some educational opportunities for ethnic minorities to position themselves to that next level, whatever that next level may be. But we also want to make sure that we tap into educating those hiring agents, whether they're presidents or search firms, or other corporate organizations and companies who really want to be able to focus on more hiring. That includes recruitment, retention, and advancement of ethnic minorities. So we're continuously forming partnerships with a number of companies to make sure that they know that there are a lot of talented ethnic minorities out there that they can take into consideration.
China Jude again visiting with us. I'll talk about the young men and women that you run into here at Wyoming. Identifying them, talking about these opportunities, do you do a lot of that? And is that something that all schools should be doing?
Oh, definitely. All schools definitely should be doing it. This is a great industry. As a matter of fact, this was my fourth career that I got into, and I love every second of it. And thanks to Tom Berman, the athletic director who gave me the opportunity to work here. But we have a number of student athletes, ethnic minorities as well as ethnic minorities, who really would like to learn more about not only this particular industry, but really a number of industries that they're feeling passionate about. So to make sure that they see someone like me on an everyday basis and interacting with other students, overseeing events and programming, it really gives them the opportunity to learn more about what I do. And from time to time, a number of student athletes will come in my office and ask, what do you do? Because we see you everywhere. And it's kind of interesting because many of them have miscategorized me in different positions. They think I'm overseeing academics, or they think I oversee other areas where I don't, because I am engaged and around a lot. And I love that they have the opportunity to see me that way. So the more that they're willing to learn, the more that I'm willing to share.
Maybe just a last thing as you take this new role. What other things are out there that you really want to accomplish while you get to be in charge?
Definitely would love to tap more into the high school level. We want to make sure that our administrators on the high school level would be able to connect with the college level, because there is a connection. We want to continue to provide some educational opportunities for them. We have a small population of the professional level representatives in the various sports, Major League Soccer and NBA. So we're hoping to grow in that particular space. But coaches also need some support as well. Coaches typically don't hire coaches unless it's a head coach hiring an assistant coach. But it's administrators like me who are looking for great educators to join our team so we can help support our student athletes. And of course, in the space of student athletes who are probably looking for that career, we do want them to consider athletic administration as a very good option. You know, it doesn't matter if you're majoring in finance or medicine or law. There's always a job in the world of athletics, and I'm fortunate to have my doctorate in athletic administration to speak on even the research side of this industry. So much growth in this industry, and I'm really looking forward to the future on how MOA can be a part of this.
China Jude, a pleasure. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you very much.
Next, we'll attend the grand reopening of the State Capitol building. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. After over 4 years and $300 million, people in Wyoming got to see what the restoration of the Wyoming Capitol looks like. The building had been falling apart, and several lawmakers argued that something had to be done. But spending money on the project and the adjoining office building was questioned by many across the state, since it came at a time when Wyoming was strapped for money. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports, things have changed.
Good, how you doing?
An estimated 2,000 people stood in front of the Capitol last Wednesday for a chance to get a peek at the facility. The building was restored and renovated. The goal was to take it back to how it looked around the time of statehood, while finally solving problems caused by having such an old building, which included very small committee rooms. Former Senate President Tony Ross was among those who oversaw the project, and he proudly told the crowd that the Capitol is once again open for business.
It's the people's house, and we've made it so for you, more so than ever before.
After a number of speakers, there was a ribbon cutting.
Okay, here we go. One, two.
Then people were allowed in. The building now features uncovered paintings, art, and decorative walls that were restored to their original splendor after being covered up multiple times over the years. This includes a historic room that served as the Supreme Court that had been converted into an office space. Featuring gold and light blue wallpaper that was restored using computer technology, the room is a highlight. There's even a balcony. Oh, by the way, that's also where legislation was signed to give women the right to vote. The House and Senate carpet and walls have been returned to their original colors, and the light now streams through a window behind the Speaker of the House desk. Among those getting a glimpse of the facility were Amy and Harlan Edmonds of Cheyenne. Both are former state representatives who were initially concerned about some of the spending, but apparently those days are over.
I mean, it's stunning. It's so beautiful. I'm most excited about this gorgeous, the old judiciary. It's so beautiful.
Although husband Harlan isn't sure about the window in the house.
I think it would take some getting used to. It's having the natural sunlight is...
Maybe some sunglasses.
But I haven't seen the committee rooms yet, but I assume they're probably the single best improvement because those were sardine cans.
The committee rooms are better and bigger with technology that will allow some meetings to be streamed online. Denver resident Susanna De La Salde was with her husband, who sculpted four unique statues that have been placed at the top of the rotunda called Truth, Justice, Courage, and Hope. She says the Capitol is a treasure.
It's so dignifying. It's so... You can see the work of everybody in each corner, in each piece that they've done with so much love. It's wonderful. It speaks volumes. It's a building that speaks loudly.
That's music to the ears of Paul Brown, who is one of the project managers. He says they had to be painstaking in their approach.
Every time we turned around, we discovered something new. We'd find a piece of
history that hadn't been revealed before, and we were able to uncover that. And so it's been really interesting from the beginning, but it was very difficult.
Former Governor Matt Mead went back and forth on moving forward with the project, but he eventually came around. Now, he is very impressed.
It is inspiring. It really is inspiring. And I think that is important for young people that go through there, our future leaders. You know, they need to see there's a special place and they should aspire to wanting to serve there.
Top elected officials are moving their offices into the facility, and it will be fully operational very soon. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Since 1983, the U-Cross Artist Residency in Northeast Wyoming has been a place for artists and writers to focus on their art and break away from their daily routines. Despite boasting a long list of award-winning alumni, the U-Cross Foundation has been thinking about how it can do better when it comes to diversity. So it created an opportunity to attract more Native American artists to its residency program. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports from the celebration of the program's first Native American Fellows.
The U-Cross Foundation's ranch is usually very quiet and serene, but tonight, the art gallery that sits on the grounds is filled with the sounds of people and the art itself. On this summer night, U-Cross is celebrating an exhibition opening for two important former residents, its first Native American Artist Fellows. The U-Cross Foundation is home to a residency program that allows artists, writers, and composers to come to the ranch in northeastern Wyoming and focus on their work without any of the distractions of their regular lives. The residency program has been around since the 1980s and has many celebrated alumni. But U-Cross Foundation Board of Trustees member Lisa Hachadorian says over the years, the board and staff started talking about bringing more diverse artists to U-Cross.
Because we saw that there was a gap in representation and opportunities.
So in 2017, U-Cross announced its fellowship for Native American visual artists. The fellowship includes a month-long residency, a stipend, and the promise of an exhibition of the artist's work at the U-Cross Gallery. Artists Brenda Mallory and Sydney Purcell were the first recipients of the fellowships and attended residencies last year. Purcell says she was excited about the opportunity since she had just finished graduate school and didn't have a lot of time to work on her art.
There's so much history of Natives in this land and all over the United States, really. So it's really exciting to see opportunities being opened up to that population.
U-Cross board member Bill Gilbert says the Native American history and culture in the U-Cross area was a big inspiration for offering the fellowship.
We're in the High Plains here, right in the middle of what was a very extensive Native American culture. So geographically and culturally, it makes sense for us to be involved in Native American arts. It's where we are.
Gilbert says the fellowship was created as a way to get recognition for more contemporary Native American artists.
Native American culture hasn't been sufficiently respected and represented in contemporary art. We have great respect for the Native traditional arts, but we haven't really done enough to bring Native artwork into the conversation in contemporary art.
And fellow Brenda Mallory says that's important because not all Native American artists do traditional art like many expect them to.
What is Native art? We are contemporary people who live in this contemporary world. We make work. And that work may reflect traditional ways of making, or it may reflect more of the Indo-European cultures that we live in here.
Still, both Mallory and Purcell say their art sometimes takes on Native themes. For instance, while at U-Cross, Purcell said she made a rainbow curtain out of beer bottle caps in the same way a traditional healing dress is made. U-Cross board member Lisa Hachadorian says she's been impressed by both Mallory and Purcell's art. So impressed that she wanted the exhibition to go to the Museum of Art in Fort Collins, Colorado, where Hachadorian is the director.
The art world can be stratified on a lot of different levels, and this particular fellowship kind of evens the playing field out a little bit.
And exposure is one of the biggest benefits for the fellows. The exhibition will stay at the U-Cross Gallery through September. After that, it will travel down to the University of Wyoming for a showing. Purcell says the attention has been one of the lasting benefits of the fellowship.
Definitely for me, not being someone that's ever worked within the gallery system, I'm getting a lot of exposure through that.
The UCross board and staff say they're pleased with how the program has gone so far. They've already announced the second round of visual arts fellows. Board member Gilbert says they also plan to expand the fellowship to Native American writers and those who work in the performing arts.
And then we're starting now to reach out to curators of Native American art to see if there's ways that we can help our artists get connected with curators and help curators with promoting the Native arts, and hopefully from the curators get new artists to come here so that it all builds.
Both Mallory and Purcell say they are thankful for the opportunity and they hope to see the fellowship reach more artists. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in UCross.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Open Spaces. If you missed something or want to hear something over again, you can do that at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. Also, never miss an episode by signing up for our podcast on that website or wherever you get your podcasts. And also be sure to rate it. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.